welcome to In the News, the Science News of the New York Times section of June 26, 2024. I'm Rick Anderson, and I'll be reading selected stories from that edition. Our first story says, China becomes the first country to retrieve rocks from the moon's far side. The Chang'e 6 missions sample, which might be holding clues about the origins of the moon and Earth, is the latest achievement of China's lunar exploration program. The story is by Katrina Miller. China brought a capsule full of lunar soil from the far side of the moon down to Earth on Tuesday, achieving the latest success in an ambitious schedule to explore the moon and other parts of the solar system. The sample, retrieved by the China National Space Administration's Chang'e 6 lander after a 53-day mission, highlights China's growing capabilities in space and notches another win in a series of lunar missions that started in 2007 and have so far been executed almost without flaw. The Chang'e 6 is the first mission in human history to return samples from the far side of the moon. Long Zhao, a planetary geologist at the China University of Geosciences, wrote in an email, "This is a major event for scientists worldwide," he added, "and a cause for celebration for all humanity." Such sentiments and the prospects of international lunar sample exchanges highlighted the hope that China's robotic missions to the Moon and Mars will serve to advance scientific understanding of the solar system. Those possibilities are contrasted by views of Washington and elsewhere that Tuesday's achievement is the latest milestone in a 21st century space race with geopolitical overtones. In February, the privately operated American spacecraft landed on the moon. NASA is also pursuing the Artemis campaign to return Americans to the lunar surface, although its next mission, flight by astronauts around the moon, has been delayed because of technical issues. China, too, is looking to expand its presence on the moon, landing more robots there, and eventually human astronauts in the years to come. Building toward that goal, it has taken a slow and steady approach. Executing a robotic lunar exploration program it devised decades in advance. Named after the Chinese moon goddess Chang'e, pronounced Chang'e, the program's first two missions orbited the moon to photograph and map its surface. Then came Chang'e 3, which landed on the lunar's near side in 2013 and deployed a rover, Yutu 1. It was followed in 2019 by Chang'e 4, which became the first vehicle to visit the moon's far side and put the U2, a rover, on the surface. 1 year later, it landed Chang'e 5, which sent nearly 4 pounds of near-side lunar regolith to the Earth. The achievement made China only the third country, after the United States and Soviet Union, to achieve the complex orbital choreography of collecting a sample from the moon. According to Yuqi Chan, a lunar geologist at the University of Hong Kong, the maneuvers of Chang'e 5 and Chang'e 6 are both test runs for China's future crewed missions to the moon, which, like the Apollo missions of the 1960s and 70s, need to land and then launch humans from the lunar surface. While it works towards putting astronauts on the moon, China's long-term strategy is paying scientific benefits for understanding the solar system. The Chang'e 5 sample was younger than the lunar material collected by the Americans or Soviets in the 1960s and 70s. It is mainly made up of basalts or cool lava from ancient volcanic eruptions. New Chinese-led research teams concluded that the basalts were about 2 billion years old, suggesting that volcanic activity on the moon extended at least a billion years beyond the time frame deduced from the U.S. Apollo and Soviet Luna samples. Other studies of the material ruled out theories about how the moon's insides have warmed enough to generate volcanic activity. One research group found that the amounts of radioactive elements in the lunar surface, which could decay and produce heat, were not high enough to cause the eruptions. Another result ruled out water in the mantle as a potential source of the interior melting that led to volcanism. Chang'e 6, launched on May 3rd, with an even grander scientific ambition, bringing back material from the far side of the moon. The near side of the moon is dominated by wide, dark plains where ancient lava once flowed. But the far side has fewer of these plains. It is also more craters and a thicker crust. Because about half never faces Earth, it is impossible to directly communicate with landers on the lunar side, making it difficult to reach successfully. The Chinese Space Agency relied on two satellites it previously launched into orbit around the moon, Chikyao 6 and Chikyao 2, to remain in touch with Chang'e 6 during the visit. The spacecraft used the same techniques as Chang'e 5 to reach the moon and then return its sample to the Earth. After a few weeks in lunar orbit, Chang'e 6 descended to a site at the edge of the South Pole Aitken Basin, the oldest, deepest impact crater on the moon. Equipped with a mechanical scoop and a drill, the lander spent 2 days gathering lunar rock and dust from its surroundings and the moon's subsurface. It then stashed the material away, and the mission deployed a miniature rover that snapped a picture of the lander with a small Chinese flag raised. And on June 3rd, a rocket flung the sample canister back into lunar orbit. The materials then reunited on June 6th with a spacecraft that had been remaining in orbit and prepared to begin the journey back to Earth. The sample container re-entered the Earth's atmosphere at 1:41 p.m. local time, moving at speeds of about 25,000 miles per hour, according to Xinhua, a Chinese state agency. Its parachute opened about 6 miles above the ground. Capsule, scorched from its passage through the atmosphere, landed at Zizhuang Banner area of the Inner Mongolia in 2:07 p.m. local time. Chinese flag planted near the pod flapped in the wind as ground crews worked to recover the material. Chiang Wang, a Chinese National Space Administration's deputy chief designer of Chang'e 6, told Xinhua that part of the sample will be permanently stored. The rest will be distributed to researchers in China and abroad, he said. When scientists take possession of the far side soils, they will compare its two halves to evolve differently. New samples will inevitably lead to new discoveries, Wai Yang, a researcher at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, told Xinhua. Chinese scientists are eagerly anticipating the opportunity to contribute to lunar science. The mission will also be looking for material from surrounding regions blasted from their original sites by impacts with comets and asteroids. Strong enough, those collisions may have excavated material from the lower crust of the moon and its upper mantle, Dr. Chan said. That would lead to insights about the structure and composition of the lunar interior. Melted rock from the impacts could also yield clues about the age of the South Pole Aitken Basin and the era in which it formed, during which scientists believe a barrage of asteroids and comets bombarded the inner solar system. This period totally changed the geologic history of the moon, Dr. Chan said, and was also a critical time for the evolution of the Earth. That story does continue, but we'll move on to another topic. Are we loving our pets to death? Pet owners are treating their animal charges ever more like humans. That isn't good for pets, or for us, many experts argue. The story is by Linda Baker. Pets are more popular than ever. Roughly 2/3 of American homes have at least one pet, up from 56% in 1988, according to the American Pet Products Association, and Americans spent $136.8 billion on their pets in 2022, up from $123.6 billion in 2021. An estimated 91 million households in Europe own at least one pet, an increase of 20 million over the past decade. Pet population in India hit 31 million in 2021, up 10 million from 2011. And our pets are becoming ever more like us, or at least that seems to be our goal. We pamper them with customized nutrition plans and knapsack carriers, dog hydrotherapy, and stays in boutique cat hotels. At All the Best, a high-end pet store chain in Seattle, the most popular items are feline and canine enrichment toys designed to stimulate them and bring happiness to animals that increasingly are lying around alone and bored, said Annie McCall, the chain's marketing director. Now some animal welfare ethicists and veterinary scientists are wondering if in our efforts to humanize our pets, we've gone too far. The more we treat pets like people, they argue, the more constrained and dependent on us our pets' lives have become, and the more health and behavioral issues our pets develop. We now view pets not only as family members, but as equivalent to children, said James Serpell, an emeritus professor of ethics and animal welfare at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. Problem is, dogs and cats are not children, and owners have become increasingly protective and restrictive. So, animals are not able to express their own doggy and catty natures as freely as they might. Health risks begin with breeding, of course. One of the most popular dog breeds in the United States is the French Bulldog, a member of the brachiocephalic family of flat-faced dogs that bond well with people but have trouble breathing, among other severe health problems. But are we also changing our animals' relationship to their surroundings? Out of concerns about bird predation, many cats now spend their entire lives inside. Until the late 1970s, even city dogs spent most of their times outdoors, either in backyards or roaming unleashed through the neighborhood. Now, said Jessica Pierce, a bioethicist in Colorado, whose work focuses on animal-human relationships, the unleashed and loose dog is considered against the natural order of things. One of the fastest-growing market segments is the so-called pet confinement sector, which includes crates and indoor fencing, as well as head harnesses and electronic collars. The level of constraint that dogs face is profound, Dr. Pierce said. Although dogs several decades ago were more likely to be hit by cars, she added, these risks were outweighed by the freedom of experience and movement. The modern pet paradox, in a nutshell, owners don't want dogs to act like dogs, Dr. Serpell said. While dogs are allowed in an ever-increasing number of human spaces, restaurants, offices, stores, hotels, as well as more parks with designated dog runs, their growing presence has not translated into greater independence. The confinement and isolation, in turn, have bred an increase in animal separation anxiety and aggression, Dr. Serpell said. Roughly 60% of cats and dogs are now overweight or obese. And due in part to the burden and expense of modern pet ownership, veterinary fees, pet sitters, boarding costs, more people are abandoning animals to animal shelters, leading to higher rates of euthanasia. In 2023, more than 359,000 dogs were euthanized at shelters, a five-year high according to Sheltered Animals Count, an animal advocacy group. We are at an odd moment of obsession with our pets, Dr. Pierce said. There are too many of them, and we keep them too intensively. Not good for us, and it's not good for them. Granted, taming an animal has always meant striking a balance between its nature and ours. Defining freedom for a dog, an animal has been domesticated artificially and selected by humans for so long, is a really interesting puzzle, said Alexandra Horowitz, a canine cognition researcher at Barnard College. She drew a contrast with free-ranging dogs a category to which most of the world's estimated 900 million dogs belong. Free roaming canines lead shorter lives and have no guarantee of food, Dr. Horowitz noted, but they do get to make all of their own choices. That is an interesting model for us to look at, thinking about how to make a dog's life more rich with choices so that they are not just captive to our caprices all of the time, while endangering society at large, she said. In recent years, Scandinavian countries have started to ban breeding of some dog breeds that are particularly prone to disease, such as the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. In Sweden, it is illegal to leave pets alone at home for extended periods of time. In both Sweden and Finland, crating animals in the home is illegal in most cases. But whether these animal welfare policies reconcile or reinforce the fundamental paradox of modern pet keeping is unclear, said Harold Herzog, an emeritus professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, who studies animal-human relations. The more we view dogs and cats as autonomous creatures, the less we can justify owning them as pets, he said. A few years ago, Dr. Herzog vacationed in the island of Tobago and spent much of the time watching the stray dogs that roam the landscape. I asked myself, would I rather live in Manhattan as a pampered dog, or would I rather be a dog in Tobago hanging out with my friends? Dr. Herzog said. He concluded, I'd rather be a dog in Tobago. That's not a practical option for most people and necessarily good for the Tobagos of the world. Instead, for the modern pet owner, Dr. Sappel had this advice. By all means, enjoy your dog's companionship. Dogs are not people. Get to know the animal from its own perspective instead of forcing them to comply with yours. We turn now to another story in which the question is posed, do we need language? A group of neuroscientists argue that our words are primarily for communicating and not for reasoning. The story is by Carl Zimmer. For thousands of years, philosophers have argued about the purpose of language. Plato believed it was essential for thinking. Thought is a silent inner conversation of the soul with itself, he wrote. Many modern scholars have advanced similar views. Starting in the 1960s, Noam Chomsky, a linguist at MIT, argued that we use language for reasoning and other forms of thought. If there is a severe deficit of language, there will be a severe deficit of thought, he wrote. As an undergraduate, Evelina Fedorenko took Dr. Chomsky's class and heard him describe his theory. I really liked the idea, she recalled, but she was puzzled by the lack of evidence. A lot of things he was saying were just stated as if they were fact, the truth, she said. Dr. Fedorenko went on to become a cognitive neuroscientist at MIT using brain scanning to investigate how the brain produces language. After 15 years, her research has led her to a startling conclusion. We don't need language to think. When you start evaluating it, you just don't find support for this role of language in thinking, she said. When Dr. Fedorenko began his work in 2009, studies had found that the same brain regions required for language were also active when people reasoned or carried out arithmetic. But Dr. Fedorenko and other researchers discovered that this overlap was a mirage. Part of the trouble with the early results was that the scanners were relatively crude. Scientists made most of their fuzzy scans by combining the results from all the volunteers, creating an overall average of brain activity. In her own research, Dr. Fedorenko used more powerful scanners and ran more tests on each volunteer. These steps allowed her and her colleagues to gather enough data from each person to create a fine-grained picture of an individual brain. Scientists then ran studies to pinpoint brain circuits that were involved in language tasks, such as retrieving words from memory and following rules of grammar. In a typical experiment, Volunteers read gibberish, followed by real sentences. Scientists discovered certain brain regions that became active only when volunteers processed actual language. Each volunteer had a language network, a constellation of regions that became active during language tasks. It's very stable, Dr. Fedorenko said. If I scan you today, and 10 or 15 years later, it's going to be in the same place. Researchers then scan the same people as they perform different kinds of thinking, such as solving a puzzle. Other regions in the brain are working really hard when you're doing all these forms of thinking, she said. But the language networks stayed quiet. It became clear that none of these things seemed to engage language circuits, she said. In a recent paper published in Nature, Dr. Fedorenko and her colleagues argued that studies of people with brain injuries point to the same conclusion. Strokes and other forms of brain damage can wipe out the language network, leaving people struggling to process words and grammar, a condition known as aphasia. But scientists have discovered that people can still do algebra and play chess, even with aphasia. In experiments of people of aphasia that can look at two numbers, 123 and 321, say, and recognize that, by using the same pattern, 456 should be followed by 654. If language is not essential for thought, then what is language for? Communication, Dr. Fedorenko and her colleagues argued. Chomsky and other researchers have rejected that idea, pointing out the ambiguity of words and the difficulty of expressing our intuitions out loud. The system is not well designed in many functional respects, Dr. Chomsky once said. But larger studies have suggested that languages have been optimized to transfer information clearly and efficiently. In one study, researchers found that frequently used words are shorter, making languages easier to understand and speeding the flow of information. In another study, researchers who investigated 37 languages found that the rules of grammar put words close to each other so that their combined meaning is easier to understand. Kyle Mahuwald, a linguist at the University of Texas at Austin, who was not involved in the new work, said that separating thought and language could help explain why artificial intelligence systems like ChatGPT are so good at some tasks and so bad at others. Computer scientists train these programs on vast amounts of text, uncovering rules about how words are connected. Dr. Mahuwald suspects that these programs are starting to mimic the language network in the human brain, but falling short on reasoning. It's possible to have very fluent grammatical text that may or may not have coherent underlying thought, Dr. Mahuwald said. But Guy Dove, a philosopher at the University of Louisville, thought that Dr. Fedorenko and his colleagues were going too far in banishing language from thought, especially complex thoughts. When we're thinking about democracy, we might rehearse conversations about democracy, he said. You do not need language to have thoughts, but it can be an enhancement. And we begin our final article, which says the mysterious deep-dwelling microbes that sculpt our planet, Earth's crust, teems with subterranean life, but we are now only beginning to understand. The story is by Faris Jabbar. In the middle of North America, there is a portal to the deep recesses of Earth's rocky interior. The portal's mouth, a furrowed pit about a half a mile wide, spirals 1,200 feet into the ground, exposing a marbled mosaic of young and ancient rock. Gray bands of basalt, milky veins of quartz, and shimmering constellations of gold. Beneath the pit, some 370 miles of tunnels twist through solid rock, extending more than 1.5 miles below the surface. For 126 years, this site in Lead, South Dakota, housed the Homestake Mine, the deepest and most productive gold mine on the continent. In 2006, the Barrick Gold Corporation donated the mine to the state of South Dakota, converted it into the largest subterranean laboratory in the United States, the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Although the lowest tunnels flooded after mining ceased, it is still possible to descend nearly a mile beneath the planet's surface. Most of the scientists, who are physicists conducting highly sensitive experiments that must be shielded from interfering cosmic rays, but a few biologists also venture into the underground labyrinth, typically seeking its dankest and dirtiest corners, places where obscure creatures extrude metal and transfigure rock. On a bitingly cold December morning, I followed three young scientists and a group of Sanford employees into the cage, the bare metal elevator that would take us 4,850 feet into Earth's crust. We wore neon vests, steel-toed boots, and hard hats. Strapped to our belts were personal respirators, which would protect us from carbon monoxide in the event of a fire or explosion. The cage descended swiftly and surprisingly smoothly. Our idle chatter and laughter were just about audible over the din of unspooling cables and whooshing air. After a controlled plummet of about 10 minutes, we reached the bottom of the facility. Our two guides, both former miners, directed us into a pair of small linked rail cars and drove us through a series of narrow tunnels. Within 20 minutes, we had traded the relatively cool and well-ventilated region near the cave for an increasingly hot and muggy corridor. Whereas the surface world was snowy and well below freezing, a mile down it was about 90 degrees with nearly 100% humidity. Heat seemed to pulse through the rock surrounding us, and the air was thick and cloying. The smell of brimstone seeped into our nostrils. It felt as though we had entered hell's foyer. The rail car stopped. We stepped out and walked a short distance to a large plastic spigot protruding from the rock. A pearly stream of water trickled from the wall near the faucet's base, forming rivulets and pools. Wafting from the water was hydrogen sulfide, the source of the chamber's odor. Kneeling, I realized that the water was teeming with stringy white material similar to the skin of a poached egg. Caitlin Kazar, geobiologist, explained that the white fibers were microbes in the genus Thiothrix, which join together in long filaments and store sulfur in their cells, giving them a ghostly hue. Here we were, deep in the Earth's crust, in a place where, without human intervention, there would be no light and little oxygen. Yet life was literally gushing from rock. This particularly ecological hotspot had earned the name Thiothrix Falls. On a different level of the mine, we sloshed through mud and shin-high water, stepping carefully to avoid tripping on submerged rails and gray stray stones. Here and there, delicate white crystals, mostly like gypsum or calcite, ornamented the ground and walls, glimmering like stars. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson reading selected stories from the New York Times Science section as of June 26, 2024. Thanks for listening, and hey, let's do this again next week.